Today's conversation is with Emily Ann Peterson from Bare Naked Bravery. And this is one of my favourite conversations, actually, because we really have a lot in common in terms of the things that we're really interested in. We're both very curious about what makes people brave. And we talk a lot about vulnerability. We talk a lot about bravery. We talk a lot about the boxes that we put ourselves in and the labels that we put on those boxes. This is the kind of conversation that I started Carlosophies to have. I'm so excited to bring this to you. And the best part is, except I kind of fucked it up a little bit, what we were supposed to do was go live on the same day, but somewhere along the lines, we got the dates mixed up. So this has gone a couple of days later than Emily's interview with me. But if you want to check out my own story, and I really peel back the band-aid on this one, it's Bare Naked Bravery. You can find it in iTunes. And if you're one of Emily's peeps, welcome. I hope you subscribe and, you know, let's form a bit of a relationship. I really love this interview, and I'm so honoured Emily came on the show. I know you guys, particularly have been around here for a little while, are going to dig the shit out of this chick. So let's dive in. Welcome to Carlosophies, Stories Behind Success. I'm Carly Nimmo. It's so easy to fall into comparisonitis as an entrepreneur, and it can be paralysing. In my own journey, I've come to understand that regardless of your level of success, fame, or fortune, we're all suffering from the same stories of fear, struggle, and failure. So let's talk about it.
I was born in Würzburg, Germany. My dad and mom met overseas when my mom was a missionary and my dad was in the U.S. military. They had like a 6-month long distance relationship and then got married. And mom was a musician, a touring musician. And when she married dad, you know, became a military wife. And I was born. And then 6 months later, dad decided, oh, I don't know if being a military dad is something that I want to do. And so they moved back to the U.S. and we stayed in Georgia, where I'm originally from, where my dad's side of the family is, in Atlanta. And dad got his PhD in marketing research, international marketing research. And so I think a lot of people's backgrounds start with their parents' backgrounds, of course, that only makes sense, you know. But I am definitely a pretty perfect combination of my parents in terms of like interests and skills and all of that. So I, you know, grew up with music around the house. I grew up with having these really philosophical, cultural, very cultural conversations around the dinner table. And so I naturally have this curiosity for differences across cultures and kind of an inquisitive what's under the surface personality. Both of my parents are very, I don't know if they would agree with me when they hear, if they were are to hear this. So hi mom, hi dad. But I would describe them as overachieving perfectionists. In the U.S. and especially in the South, that's a hard thing for kids to, or girls especially, to grow up in. Our family had, this is a doozy because you can kind of tell I'm circling around the subject and I'm not right really like landing on it.
Let's just not send this to your mom and dad.
Yeah, let's not do that. So we'll just have to hope. Yeah. So let's just say that I had an eating disorder when I was in high school. It was sucky. I think, you know, like a lot of eating disorders stem from this lack of expression in someone's life in one way or another. Like it's this, and I'm using expression in like a large term, not just like, I don't have a voice or I can't speak up or whatever. But there was this cultural level of being cooped up and restrained and held back. And then there was also a familial tribal constraint as well of, you know, you have to achieve these things, do the goals and make these grades and be this way and don't dress that way and all of this stuff. And my parents
have all... Can I ask you a question? Sorry.
Yeah, ask away.
So is it like a control thing? Was it a control thing? Like you felt like perhaps you didn't have control in other areas of your life. And so that was one area that you could have control over.
Yeah. And it also was more obvious, you know, in a lot of cases, I would say that an eating disorder is not as obvious as society tells me I need to lose weight. Therefore I do it too much. Like you go overboard. There is definitely that element, but like you said, there's, you know, as with many mental disorders, there are other not so obvious connections, like you mentioned, that are related. And for me, it was the control issue. And I think that's like quite possibly the opposite of expression is control.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, you and I have talked about that above the line, below the line stuff before. I think that when I'm feeling out of balance as a person, I end up trying to control too much. For some people, an eating disorder is a manifestation of OCD. And that actually comes up now in various little tiny ways as an adult. There was a season where I was living in a house with like 7 other roommates and it was a blast. It was fun. But as you can imagine, with 7 roommates, you don't have a lot of control over your environment. And there was one day where I was in the kitchen and I was fixing the hooks that held all of the like kitchen towels had a tendency to get off and like crooked. It was like one of those like blackout moments where I came to and all of the hooks were like straightened and I had no intention of straightening the hooks.
I laugh, but that's because I know I do the same thing, you know, and it's funny when I feel like everything is out of control in my life or like, for me, it neat. I like to have things neat, but then I get things into such a mess and then it's so overwhelming for me. And then in that moment, something clicks and I just go hell for leather, like almost maniacal, cleaning up, making sure everything is perfectly in its place. Like when things get overwhelming, I think it's kind of a natural response for us to want to then have some level of control over it.
Right. Well, in that specific moment, the kitchen hooks moment, that particular day, I was like behind. I was running late. I had to do a bunch of stuff. And I came to and realized I just spent 5 minutes fixing something that did not need to be fixed at all. I can do that later. That is not a priority. And somehow my brain just was like, control the one thing you can. And I think that's what happened when I was younger and I didn't have the maturity that I do now. And I hadn't gone through all of the talk therapy that I went through and the self-discovery that you do when you're in your 20s. And I'm 30 now. So yeah, the healing process of the eating disorder was really fascinating because I had many of those blackout moments where I don't actually black out. Like I say, of course, awake and awake, but not fully conscious, I guess.
Yeah. Like an autopilot kind of response.
Yeah, definitely. It's like the best way to describe it is like when you get in the car and you just go all the way home and you get home and you don't actually remember every step of the way there, but somehow you're safe and you're home and whatever. So I had one of those moments in college. Well, let me go back. So I accepted an Air Force ROTC scholarship for college. And I did that because I think my parents were a little bit, they were worried about money for college education. And I really wanted to go to college out in Nashville and do music business of some sort. But the money was a worry and the Air Force scholarship would like go further if I stayed in state in Texas at the time was where we were living. And so I went to Texas Tech University and did my first year of college with the Air Force. And I actually think that that scholarship in some cases really saved my life, because prior to that, in my the worst of the eating disorder, like I was the one that was trying to control every element of my life, like the eating and the exercise and the everything. And then when I joined the Air Force, there was this external institution that was telling me, that was giving me the numbers and giving me the rituals and the everything that I needed.
Yeah, like the structure.
Yeah, I needed that structure. And that structure really did give me the freedom to let go and the freedom to not be so hard on myself. So after a year of that, I realized, not surprisingly, that the Air Force was not fully my career of choice. You can do the first year with no strings attached, which is really great. That's the whole idea behind officer training corps. They're just trying to get people to test out the whole military career idea. So I decided to bow out, and the next year of college, I'm middle of the semester, probably before midterms, I'm just guessing. I'm walking up the stairs of my dorm, and I have in my hand a box of laxatives that I had sworn off when I got to college. And I just knew, I was like, I just blacked out and went to the drugstore and purchased a box of laxatives not of my own volition. This is bad. Something's really awful. And I had one of those breakdown moments where I called a friend, completely blubbering, and she knew what I needed. She came over and we called the psychiatrist, the school psychiatrist, and had an appointment the next day. And the psychiatrist heard the everything that I was going through and just said, you have an eating disorder. And I was like, no shit. And she goes, it was really great. She was one of the first fairy godmothers that I had. Like I have in my arsenal a list of fairy godmothers, and she was the first one. She just happened to be wearing like clogs and a white coat, you know? And she said, the thing she told me was, you don't have to live like this. And that was all I needed, was just permission to not keep pushing in that direction. I would not wish an eating disorder or any other mental illness on anybody else, even my worst enemy. I wouldn't do that for. It's torture. And I know that you've talked about depression and all of the other, and this subject matter comes up in your show a lot, and I resonate with it because I experienced it too, and it sucks hardcore.
It does suck.
It really does.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But having said that, it's also been my greatest teacher.
Oh, yeah. So it really does suck hardcore. The thing that really saved me or kept me from not being hospitalized when I was younger and in the worst of it was two things: journaling and being a musician. Ironically, I was a classical musician, so that's like very rigid, very structured, very much standards and perfectionist, you know, heavy. It's a tricky there's a lot of decisions that I made in my life that I was like, that I look back on and go, how did not that not just tip me over? But the music really was, I learned how to lose myself in the meditation of practice. And I didn't know that that's what I was doing at the time. I know now because I've experienced meditation and I know how important that is. But the journaling and the practice, the daily instrument practice, was the two things that really saved my life. And the Air Force, I guess, which is so strange for me to say.
I know. It's funny, though, because While you've been talking, I've been thinking about, and I've obviously been listening to you too, but the theme that kind of has come up for me is that idea of, you know, for me, you seem like such a free spirit and, you know, and expressive, definitely a very creatively expressive person. And then there's this other side, which is like, you know, the army background with the, you know, I don't know, like the, I imagine there's a lot of structure and routine in that. And in classical music, the same, a lot of rules, a lot of things, you know, things that you have to live by. But then sometimes I've found myself within the confines of a box, there is a lot of freedom. When there is no box, there's no, when there's no constraints to our expression, sometimes it's really hard to express because we don't really know, like, I don't know, it's like the human brain can't really comprehend things being limitless. There needs to be some kind of limits in order for us to express, you know, because when we show up, before I started Carlosophies, the idea behind it was I just wanted to have conversations like I had with my girlfriends, you know, over a coffee or over dinner, where we would just have the most insightful conversations. But what I quickly realized was without having some kind of structure around that, it was very difficult for people to feel expressive. And it put a lot of pressure on the conversation. So I created structure around it so that then there was more freedom in the expression.
Yeah.
Which kind of seems like an oxymoron or something.
It really does. But I think what was lacking at the height of my eating disorder was the intent to express myself. There was this emotional, let's say there was this emotional lid on the box of constraints. And that emotional lid was the thing that just kept it all cooped up, and it had to go somewhere, and it went internally. Like I would have imploded. You know,
I
would have looked great doing it, but I would have imploded. I fully stand by that necessity of constraints. And I actually, that topic comes up a lot in my own podcast, Bare Naked Bravery, small
which is
plug.
Awesome.
thank you. but I love talking about boundaries because, I mean, obviously I grew up in the midst of a lot of it, but I too have learned that the constraints themselves are a gift, especially if you can learn to not fight them, but learn to use them, like you were mentioning. So that comes down to budgeting, and it comes down to hiring a new person for your business. And it comes down to how you choose your next lyric for the song that you're writing. Those constraints, if you can use them, can be really powerful and can actually provide the place that from which you can be powerful, I should say. But if that intent to go somewhere beyond the constraint or around the constraint, if that intent is not there, then you're just angry at fighting against something, you know?
Yeah, because there's a difference between being boxed in and just being in a box, you know? And and the box, like, we can make the box what we want it to be. We don't have to be in somebody else's box. We can be in our own type of box. But without the walls around us, then it is hard to have direction, I guess. And the direction is really your intention.
Right. It's, you know, there, along with the cultural and familial and tribal constraints, I also had spiritual constraints as well. Our family, no surprise, was part of an evangelical, for lack of a better word, a very flamboyant yet conservative church in Texas. And flamboyant is actually a funny word to describe the church.
Considering I kind of think of Peter beliefs. Allen, when my baby,
you know? I know.
Miraculous.
But they were. It was the kind of church that, like, flew the banners and had, like, the lady that brought her own tambourine to church, you know, that kind of thing. And it was a really joyful place. But there was also a whole lot of religious constraints. And again, not too, surprisingly, there were a lot of people who believed in spiritual gifts of prophecy and speaking in tongues, whatever that is. I don't even know if I still understand. But all that crazy stuff that maybe an Episcopal or Catholic would roll their eyes at. So I grew up with still this like hard, hard box of religion without a lid. And it had this full expression that existed within it. So I found a lot of expression through, or release, I should say, through our spiritual community there in Texas. And though I know I'm not a church attendee these days, I still am very much a spiritual person, and I'm grateful for that church and that upbringing. Because I think we are all spiritual beings in some way or another, and it was a necessary place to nurture that awareness of myself, even if I was in the midst of a crazy mental disorder. You know, it was a refuge for sure.
Yeah, I grew up kind of with the opposite. So my father is very much a fatalist, I guess. He just, he doesn't believe in God. He doesn't believe in really anything. And then my mom, she's kind of just agnostic, and as a kid, I had kind of a fascination with religion and the concept of religion, but no real access to it. And then when I was maybe 8 or 9 or 10, I can't even remember, one of my friends went to Sunday school and she was really cool. So I thought, maybe I should go to Sunday school too. So I went, and it was the most bizarre thing ever. I didn't last very long because I didn't understand how this could possibly be true. You know, I had a lot of questions about it. And I didn't, at school, you know, we could choose to do RE or religious education, and it definitely wasn't part of our, you know, I was just a state school. Religion isn't a real big deal in Australia. You know, there are so many different religions, and most of the, you know, second, third, fourth generation Australians have no religion. You know, I've been to church. I went to Sunday school a few times, as I mentioned. Mm-hmm. But even then, I remember my mum and dad said, if you choose to go to Sunday school, that is your responsibility. You have to get yourself up and ready and out the door waiting for the Sunday school bus to come and pick you up. You know, you make the choice to go, then you commit to that choice and sort yourself out, kind of thing. Yeah, so it was just like a totally, different thing. But now these days I'm obsessed with, you know, I love being a spiritual person. I don't have a traditional idea of God and Jesus and all that kind of jazz. Right. In fact, I don't really know much about it. But I definitely have a sense of something bigger than myself and being part of something bigger than myself. So yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? That idea of spirituality and how we can grow up in either no box or in quite a stringent box, but through life we'll end up coming to our own version of it, perhaps.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I fully agree with that. And it's really fascinating. I have a friend who is a Methodist pastor here in Washington, and he's asked me before to give a sermon for his church, and that completely weirded me out. But I did it anyways because I was like, this is probably the only time I'm going to like voluntarily go to church is if somebody asks me to play my music for them, and I'll be like, yeah, sure, I can do that. And he's asked me again, I'm going to give another sermon in a couple weeks. And it feels like home going into a church. I know all of the lingo, every last bit of it. It's like biblical knowledge is a party trick for me right now. There was one, I was at a songwriting conference and somebody had been given the song prompt of Paul from the Bible, from the New Testament, from the Bible. And she was like, does anybody know anything about this guy in the Bible? I'm supposed to like do some research and then write a song about him. And I think he's a kind of a big deal. And I was like, I just started like releasing little facts throughout the conversation. And then like an hour and a half later, she was like, wow, you know so much about this. So it sticks in there, right? You know, like what you grew up with, it sticks in there. That's a fun bunny trail, that's for sure. Yeah. So after, you know, meeting with that psychiatrist, I started going to talk therapy. The university that I was part of had, you know, free talk therapy or free counselors for students. And I think the lady that I, you know, that they sent me to, she didn't quite know what to do with me because I was really raw. I was also on Prozac, so I was also kind of numb and raw at the same time, which is a really weird feeling. And I went home that Christmas and basically came out to my parents that I had an eating disorder, and they didn't believe me. And they, to this day, I bet they probably still doubt it for a lot of reasons, for their own reasons, but I'm fairly certain they don't fully believe that I actually had a problem, because I did a really, really good job of hiding it, you know, really did a good job. My mom actually said she was scared that I was going to tell them that I was pregnant, which is its whole other, which is a whole other bag of tricks. Like, just, like, that's the worst thing you could think of, that I was pregnant. Oh my God, mom. So
at least an eating disorder is something they can probably deny, where a pregnancy, not so much.
I know. And I'm, you know, like, as the Southern folks say, bless their heart. They were really trying. They really were. And they are really lovely people. And I do love them. We, of course, have our differences. And I'm sure, you know, my cousin actually told me the other day, or a couple months ago when I saw them, he said, you know, my favorite part about going to family reunions when you're not there, Emily, is asking your parents, well, what's Emily up to these days? And he says his favorite thing about the reunion is, like, just at the response, that he doesn't know how they're going to respond. And this last time, I think my mom said, like, oh, you know, she's just doing her thing. Just, so I think, you know, there's a real beauty to the fact that through the healing that I went through over the last 15 years, I have found that place of the place within myself that I just am fine being different and fine being unique, and have learned to find that comfort in the constraints and the boundaries. And, you know, it doesn't always feel comfortable. Mm-mm. It, you know, when you're amidst all of those constraints and everything, but there is a familiarity within myself that I can always reach to, that allows me to just be okay with what I'm doing and who I am without anybody else's opinions of that. So today, yeah. I'm doing, you know, I do a lot of creative stuff, and through my healing process later on down the road, I moved to Seattle and found myself in the Northwest, you know, spent the last 10 years teaching cello lessons as a classical music teacher, but kind of a woo-woo classical music teacher. You love know, like it. I'll talk about, like, in our lessons, I end up talking about weird stuff like meditation and, like, feeling the energy through your arm and that kind of stuff. And I have a couple students that roll their eyes at me, you know, like, they don't quite understand. They just kind of go with it, and magically they end up sounding better, you know. Finding that place of fulfillment from a career was really, really, really cool. But I did, per my use, I did go all out and almost burn myself out in the process. And one of the things that happened through that burnout was I was, for about 4 years ago, was diagnosed with a tremor in my right hand, which is hereditary. So thanks, mom. And it's actually her dad's side of the family that, or no, her mom's side of the family that that has it. So my grandmother, her head shakes all the time. And her dad, I remember going out in my great grandpa's backyard and him pointing to the pear tree, but his point, and it was just like really, really shaky. So I remember his shaky hand. And now I have that in my right hand. And it gets worse with stress. It flares up with stress. So I was, you know, really loving what I do, but really just doing it too much. And so my body was trying to like give me clues that I needed to slow it down or do something different. The tremors come up or are diagnosed usually when you're 40 and above. And I was diagnosed when I was like 26, 27. And I think a lot of it was just that I used that bow hand so much. I was using it like 8 hours a day. And I think what happened, this is also not fully medical at this point, but I think what happened was that overexertion was wearing on my stabilizer muscles, and my stabilizer muscles were already compensating for a small tremor. And then as I just got tired throughout the day, I was unable to stabilize like I used to. And I notice that now, you know, like I can't carry a bunch of boxes and then expect to have full stable hand. When I got diagnosed, it was a really sucky thing. That was like the second whammy of like, okay, I thought I was done with like these big dramatic things. You know, I thought I was on my way, you know. We're never done, are we?
Nope.
So it was definitely a moment of, it was a, as they say here, a come to Jesus moment. And I was diagnosed about a month before I left for an artist residency. I was awarded this 6-week stay at a artist community out in Leavenworth, Washington. The intent was, I applied for the residency intending to record an album of cello music. And then I got diagnosed and then went out there and just creatively sulked. I didn't touch the cello at all. Like it sat there in the corner and I just was doing everything else but cello.
Were you feeling resentment to the cello at that point? Or?
Yeah. And it also really hurt too. Yeah. It was because in my head, I knew that the tremor is degenerative. So I knew the doctor told me that the medication I was on might not work in the future because the tremor would outwiggle it basically. So I went out to the mountains kind of going like, wow, this thing that I have played for years and years and the thing that I know in some cases better than myself now is no longer a wise investment. Because if I keep investing practice time and creative time into this instrument, at some point it's just literally not going to give back to me. Financially, relationally, even sonically, it's not going to give back to me like I like it had in the past. So there was a lot of sadness. And there still is like twinges of sadness. Like I'll be driving down the road listening to some song on the radio and I'll just flip the station to another station and go like, why did I do that? I actually like that song. And I go back and listen to the song and realize, oh, that's when the cellos come in. And like my heart somehow like takes over my hand and like goes, nope, we don't want to listen to that. that's a little too close to home. No thanks. So there are some awkward moments too with people who, especially like the what do you do question, when I say, oh yeah, I'm a musician, and then the next question is, oh, what kind of music do you play? And I say, oh, well, singer-songwriter stuff, and I've learned that I can't add, but cello is my most proficient instrument to the end of that sentence, because if I mention the cello at all, the response that I'll get is, oh, I love the cello. It's such a great instrument. And then we have to talk all about the cello. And I don't want to talk all about the cello.
The fucking cello.
I know. although I do love it and it is the best instrument and I really I really do adore it. But I've just learned over the course of this like grief period that sometimes it's best to just not even bring it up. And I'm sure somebody who has lost a loved one or a like husband or a brother or sister, like you don't say, "Hi, my name is Susie. My husband just died," because then the conversation will automatically go in that direction. So there is still some power in your grief. You get to be in charge of how you want to be vulnerable in the world. And that's been a fun lesson in the last couple.
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? Because I would say I allow myself to be very vulnerable, but around certain topics. So, you know, while a lot of my stuff is, I've always been like the too much information girl, but there's still things that, that I keep in for me, just for me, not for anybody else. Maybe me and a couple of close people near me. Yeah, so we do get to choose how and when and why we are vulnerable.
If it was any other way, it wouldn't be vulnerability.
No.
Right?
Yeah.
Like if it wasn't hidden behind something to begin with.
Yeah, it wouldn't be.
Wouldn't be revealing yourself. It'd be you.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And for me, I think the things that I know, particularly now, like there's not actually a lot of vulnerability that's involved in me talking about my depression and anxiety, because now it is just part of my story. It is part of who I am. So it doesn't take a lot of vulnerability for me to really dive into that now.
Yeah.
Because I know that it's of service to other people when I talk about it. So I will get out of my own way in order to make people feel heard and understood.
Right.
So, but true vulnerability would be me going into some place where I am really uncomfortable and revealing that. And at the beginning, that was super uncomfortable. The first time that I, you know, came out of the depression closet, it's scary. You know, just I think I wrote a blog post and should I publish it? Shouldn't I publish it? Oh my God, what's the response going to be? What are people going to think? You know, all that kind of jazz goes on, and then you publish it and it's rarely as bad as you made it out to be in your head.
Yeah. You know, one thing that comes to mind is, you know, we're talking about this like boundary and context and internal environments, basically. When I moved out to Seattle and I was looking for, I got to a point with my mental health where I told a friend, I think this is really bad. I think I'm going back to that place and I don't want to go there. I've already been there. I don't want to do that. What should I do? And her suggestion, which is great advice, and I give this all the time, which is shop around for a therapist and see what happens. And I went to 4 different therapists. You know, it's kind of a pricey shopping experience, but I went to 4 different therapists, and 2 male, 2 female. And what I realized in myself was that this is also probably pretty indicative of my relationship with my dad and mom. With the male therapist, I cried like a baby. And with the female therapist, I was like stone cold, like I am with you right now. Like you and I are talking about really emotional subjects that I have cried about before.
Yeah.
But somehow with women, I am just like really matter of fact and like straightforward and like very much like news headlines kind of thing.
Yeah.
But with men, like I'm just, just become a little heap of puddle of tears, you know? And I picked my therapist based on the kinds of questions they asked me when I was in that emotional and vulnerable state. The women, of course, never got to that place because I wouldn't let them in to that place. And the 2 male therapists were, I was like weeping on their couch. And one asked me a question that I don't remember the question, but I remember distinctly going, I have never asked myself that question ever before. And the other one kind of did some like investigative questioning, you know. And I chose the therapist that asked me the question I hadn't asked myself, because
he could get more of an insight into who you were than you could.
Well, and I also thought that, you know, talk therapy is not necessarily about like solving the problem. A lot of times it's just looking at the issue at hand from a new perspective. And I didn't know how to do that for myself because I was stuck in this dark rut, right?
Yeah, and that's so often we don't. You know, we're so in our own shit that we can't see out of it.
Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, what you can ask for from a therapist is, or, you know, a counselor, whoever, is that they would help you to see a new perspective without doing it in a judgmental kind of way. You know, like, you were wrong, you should not be feeling this way, etc. That's not helpful at all. And I had received some of that, you know, especially from the spiritual community that I was in. You know, like, you go in and you tell them your problem, and I got a couple therapists that were like, well, here's a stack of scriptures that we think that you should memorize. And I would sit there with my mouth agape, like, lady, are you kidding me? Memorizing some words is not going to fix this. And I, to some degree, even in the woo-woo community, I still have that about, like, the, think happy thoughts, kind of like positive. Yeah. I'm so glad you're rolling your eyes.
Big time.
Because I still have that element of high skepticism and cynicism of memorizing something is not going to fix it. Waving a wand is not going to fix it.
I just had a conversation
buying a crystal
today.
It's not going to fix
buying another self-help book is not going to fix it. Buying another e-course is not going to fix it. I just had a conversation with a friend of mine this morning about this. You know, I had taken it that she was giving me this advice after a few meltdowns that I've had this week, but actually it wasn't meant for me. It was meant for my students. But anyway, she recommended a few books, like The Big Leap by Gay Hendricks and The Art of War or The Art of Now, I can't remember. And I'd said to her, I'm a recovered self-help bookaholic. I've got boxes and boxes, gathering dust, of books that I've read. I have an insane amount of knowledge as to what's wrong with me and how to fix it. But that knowledge is no good to anyone unless I know how to embody that change, unless I've lived physically, you know, viscerally learned those lessons. I can talk and intellectualize myself into and out of anything, but unless I can embody that change, you know, it's just words, words on paper, words in my head.
Yep. And, you know, this is one of the things that I really learned, I guess the second wave of education that I received from my cello and from even being a teacher of it. Because I was teaching cello while I was going through this mental health journey of like, okay, let's just do an overhaul. Let's figure out how to embody this thing that I want, which is mental health. As you know, not an easy fix. It is like the hardest work you'll ever do. It has to happen all day, every day. Sometimes it's nice to take a break and just like zone out, you know, and
cry like a baby, play the victim. I did that this week.
Binge watch Netflix for a week just so you don't
burn yourself out.
I remember there's a couple of therapy sessions where my therapist asked, well, what did you do over the last week? And I just said, honestly, I just taught a couple lessons and watched Netflix. And he was like, really? Is that really all you did? And I was like, yeah, that's it. And I think it's okay to take those breaks of saying, I can't think. I can't. This is such intense work. I can't do all of it right now.
Yeah. And you can burn yourself out by working on yourself too much, you know.
Oh, yeah.
It's the fine line of, you know, where the fine line is between healthy and obsessive. You know, you can very easily become obsessive about it, and that's not healthy either.
Well, there was a good 6 months of, because I was seeing a therapist for like 3 years straight, sometimes twice a week, but definitely every week. And there was a season of that that was just really hard and really rough. And he could tell, like he could tell that it was really, really tough. And it was the first time somebody had not just prescribed me medication, just said, here, this'll fix it. But he said, it doesn't have to be this hard. Like you can keep doing this work and not numb yourself out, but this work doesn't have to hurt it so bad. And so I got on a different medication, not Prozac, because clearly that numbed me out. But that was also, I'm pretty sure that was a lifesaver, like a literal lifesaver, because I was dredging up all of the difficult, dark stuff about yourself and about where you came from and how you encounter the world. And all of that's really hard. Like the world is a terrifying place. And it sometimes you really do need some help. And sometimes you need like chemical level help, not just, you know, a hand holding the door open and, you know, paying somebody to listen to you for an hour and come back the next week and repeat. So I think I talk about this on the podcast a lot too, that the moment when you ask for help, like that tipping point of this has gotten really bad, where you black out and you come to and you go, I don't need to be doing this right now. What is happening right now? Or the moment when somebody in a white coat wearing clogs says, you don't have to live like this, or your therapist says, it doesn't have to be that hard. All of those moments are really, really powerful if you have the wherewithal to listen to them and hear them. Yeah.
Yeah. So where are you at now?
So now, yay. Now I'm still doing music. I'm a singer-songwriter. So I do concerts around and I love that. I think the songwriting is really fun. I came out of the mountains from that artist residency going, oh yeah, I'm a musician first, not a cellist. I'm a musician first. I'm an artist and then a musician and then songwriter. And I came out of the mountains with this handful of songs that I thought, you know, I actually think I'm pretty good at this.
Yeah.
And I think I like doing this. Wow. So it's been, you know, like the last, you know, handful of years has been me kind of flailing about going like, whoa, this training, this new bike I'm driving, it feels funky. It's not the same thing, but it's still going in the same direction. Like I'm still a musician. I'm still expressing myself. I'm still using the same tools and I'm still providing the same transformation to my students and to I do marketing coaching and put yourself out there lessons and kind of that kind of stuff. And that's all still happening. Like I'm still the same person. It just looks a little different.
Yeah. Outside. It's funny. While you were saying that, I was thinking about the labels that we put on ourselves. So while you were a cellist,
speaking of boxes.
Yeah. Yeah. Speaking of boxes, exactly. Yeah. Boxes. And then you have a big fat label on the front. Right. You know, the cello is the instrument that you use. It's not who you are. And often we put the labels around what we do, not who we are is very different to that. So yeah, when it comes to the cello and your relationship with the cello, I'm sure it's actually much more than this, but at a very simple surface level, it's just an instrument that you use.
Yeah, it's just a piece of wood.
Yeah,
it really is. It's just a really expensive piece of wood. it did, you know, the cello really was, it affected me on a relational level. Like all of my colleagues were fellow teachers and classical musicians. And then it affected me geographically. Like I moved to Seattle to do music stuff. So there were every layer of my life had been painted by the cello in some way. And then when it was gone, I was left with this like life that represented something that it actually that I actually didn't have in my life anymore. I imagine, I talk about the grief and death and mourning process with this a lot because it's true. If I was married to a guy who bought my house and my car and everything in my life revolved around our relationship, and then he passed away for whatever reason, I would be left with a life that had a husband-shaped hole. And I was, you know, when I was in the mountains at my artist residency, I was looking at my life with this cello-shaped hole thinking, what do I do now? Like, what, truly, what do I, what now? So I started just getting curious and I started listening to those constraints and feeling out what I knew I could do and what I didn't think I could do and or what wasn't actually realistically feasible. So I actually started getting really curious about the subject of bravery and courage, specifically creative courage, and the cycle that happens between the two of them. Like, the more creative you are, the more courageous you are, and it works its way out like a spiral. It starts very small spiral, and then it can work its way out. And oftentimes, what we see is like really big, huge feats of bravery is just a result of that person, the hero in question, having done that creative courage process, spiraling out and out and out and out and out until they're doing crazy things like leaping from buildings and saving the world and all of that. So I got curious about it. I started writing a book, which is not yet finished. And in the process of writing the book, I started having conversations like you did about the subject matter because I was doing it for research reasons. And I was like, well, if I'm going to write a book, I want to do my due diligence and not just say, listen to me. And so the conversations I had just were really, really, really fantastic. I've always been a fan of podcasts. And I knew that the conversations I was having also needed to be heard, not just read or read about. And so a podcast was born. And yeah, there we have it. And that's the thing. That's the exciting thing I'm working on right now that I can tell you about, because there are other stuff that I can't. There's other stuff I can't tell you about just yet, because it wouldn't be vulnerable if I hadn't hidden it first. But yeah, the podcast is called Bare Naked Bravery, and it's all about what makes people brave. And the guests I have on the show are you, of course, you. And
I don't feel brave most of the time, but it's so funny, isn't it? Looking at, the person committing the act of bravery rarely really sees it as being brave.
Yes.
Scary, yes, but
yes,
brave often not. Yeah.
And I think that's a really huge lesson point that I come across all the time with people when I'm talking about this subject, is that that realization of, oh, the hero himself never thinks he's brave. And he's never going to call himself a hero. Because if he did, he wouldn't be brave. And no one else would call him a hero, you know? It's that really cool dichotomy of perspective that happens in this concept. So the podcast started with me making, I just went onto Facebook, looked at all of my Facebook friends and went through the list and said, out of all of these people, this list of 20 people, I know have a brave story. I know that they may not think that they are brave, but I know that they are brave. And that's how it started. So that's where we started, I should say, with that group of people, which I'm like thoroughly thrilled to introduce them to the rest of the world and introduce their stories to the rest of the world, because they're just great, flipping great stories, and really wonderful, generous people too. So, yeah.
Time to kick up your feet and relax. It's On the Couch. Biggest fear.
I think today it's probably rejection, just in general. That's a big doozy. Sure. I don't know how far you want me to go into these answers.
That's
but
okay. rejection
that's
is
the one for today.
Yeah. We all feel the rejection one. What are you struggling with at the moment?
Right now, I'm doing brainstorming and like vision casting for the next year. And I'm trying to challenge myself to be more intentional with how I unveil the next awesome things that I've got planned. So I tend to be kind of a blurter. Blurt the awesome news. Yeah. And I can tell that if I just take an extra minute to just decide how I'm going to do it.
Yeah. I know.
And that pertains to like launches.
Too. Yeah. I think, you know, I tend to be a jumper. So I just launch into things. I jump in like whole body, bam, straight in. And then I realize, oh, maybe there was a better way for me to, you know, execute that leap.
Oh, yeah. You look back and you go, oh, I just launched something. Maybe I should have like warned people about it or warmed them up and...
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So that's my struggle with this week. Yeah.
Cool. What about the recurring voice? So we all have like, you know, that bitch in our heads telling us the untruths. What's the common record for you?
I am in the middle of a full transition right now. I'm taking a semi-sabbatical. I say semi-sabbatical because I'm still actually working and doing the things that I'm always doing. I'm just not doing it in the Pacific Northwest. I'll be doing it in Atlanta with my dad's side of the family. Full circle moment. So I'm right now homeless. Like right now you're interviewing me in somebody's guest bedroom, one of my friend's guest bedrooms, because I had to leave my apartment early to have the lease and the whole rigmarole. So right now, the recurring thing that keeps popping up is the you're a burden message. That's always been a big one. So yeah, the last couple weeks I've been having to go like, you're not a burden. Your friends want to help you. They think it's cool that you're doing this. Just relax.
Yeah. And you know, that burden thing, like... I feel like I struggle to ask for help a lot of the time because of the burden thing too. But, you know, generally people want to help, right? But we don't allow ourselves to be vulnerable enough to allow them to help. So most people have just been waiting for you to ask. Mm-hmm. And they're honored that you asked because often they also know that you're not someone who asks.
Exactly. There's a couple of friends who when I knew I was going to need a place to stay, I asked like three or four friends. They all said, yeah, sure. Just let me know which dates you need. And I forgot, I had space cadet moment and forgot to tell one of the friends that I actually wasn't going to be staying in her house. And I get this text from her saying like, hey, are you coming? I was really looking forward to having you stay with me and all of this stuff. And I felt really bad in a really wonderful, warm, fuzzy kind of way. It's like, oh, somebody wanted to have a sleepover with me and they didn't let them. What a terrible, wonderful problem to have, you know?
For sure. So failure, what does failure mean to you?
Failure means not trying. To me.
Yeah.
For sure. Yeah.
Yeah. There's not much more to say than that, right?
No.
Cool. Okay. So what about success? What does success mean to you? What does it look like?
Well, I could just say the cheater version of that and saying success means continuing to try. Success means showing up. That's like a good like motivational poster for you. Yeah. I think in a more tangible way, success for me this next season looks like making a lot of casseroles for my grandpa and continuing to give myself time and space to write songs and put the things that I've made out into the world. And it also means continuing to help people do the same thing. Like help people put themselves out into the world, even if it's just within themselves.
And lastly, freedom.
What does freedom mean?
Yeah. And how would it look in your life?
So with the sabbatical, what it looks like is I have cut myself from all income-based, location-based income. So I've cut myself from all of the Seattle and the Northwest related income
that you're no longer
required
tethered.
Me to stay. I know, I'm no longer tethered. So I'm officially a digital nomad, which sounds more glamorous than it actually is.
And ain't that the truth?
It really is. And I actually, a friend coined the term reluctant gypsy for me because every time I have to pick up and move, which happens a lot, strangely or not so strangely, every time I have to pick up and move, there's always this like eye roll, big deep sigh that happens where it's like, okay, let's go. and I eventually like warm up to it and get excited. Like I'm in the excitement stage at this point, but like the last month or two was me going like, do I really have to sell this piece of furniture?
Yeah.
So freedom looks like to me, it means spending time with family and letting myself be untethered geographically.
The plug. Instead of filling the podcast with self-promotion, we're being totally transparent. Here's the plug.
Everything me related is at emilyannpeterson.com. And if you are curious about the podcast, then you can also go to barenakedbravery.com. They forward to the same place, but one of them is easier to spell than the other. That's what I've got going on right now. You can pre-order my next album on my website, which is super exciting. Velveteen is the title of it. Yeah.
Velvet. And it's such a nice word. Velvet.
I know. Yeah. I know. Well, one of the main songs in the album is all about the Velveteen Rabbit.
Mm, yeah.
So that's where that came from. And actually, hilariously, the album cover is just my naked body, which is an artistic photo shoot, like a really cool photo shoot that my friend Genevieve Pearson did with me. And I chose the album, chose the shot just because it was super artistic and cool looking. And then when I released the pre-order campaign, it occurred to me in a very sudden flash that by choosing that as my album cover and then doing a pre-order campaign for said album, I was therefore asking people to spread a picture of my naked body around the internet.
Bare naked bravery.
Bare naked bravery right there. So no, I got over that really quick, but it was definitely like I didn't think that through all the way. Oh.
Yeah, leap and then be like, holy shit, I'm in free flow.
Exactly. exactly. I'm excited about that album release. It's a collection of really wonderful songs that mean a lot to me and also a lot of other people as well. So it's going to be good. Going to be a good one.
The takeaway. Exercises or tips for positive change, sprinkled with salt and vinegar, wrapped in newspaper and handed over the counter from our special guest to you.
I'm just going to be shooting from the hip here. I think the takeaway that I would give is taking 15 minutes today and doing a brain dump, because that is my current way of journaling these days. I just like set the timer and just type a furious cloud of nonsense words that come out of my head. And that is like some of the most therapeutic writing that you could ever do for yourself. It's worth it. You feel ridiculous when you're doing it if you've never done it before, but it's totally worth it.
Yeah, I remember when I first started journaling, when I was diagnosed with depression, my therapist had given me, was it Julie Cameron's The Artist Way? And, yep. You know, she had the morning pages thing where you write mm-hmm. for 3 pages. And I think the first few times my 3 pages were like, what is the fucking point? I'm just trying to get to 3 pages, so I'm just writing, you know, blah, 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 blah. And then, oh, my God, than just the, you know, it was like Mount's whatever, like a volcano going off and just all this stuff started coming out. And it's, yep, you just got to trust the process, don't you? Just show up.
You really do. It's like, if I haven't done it in a while, doing that is kind of like, I don't know if you've got hand lotion where like the top part gets dried. Yeah, so it's like hard to squeeze it out. Yeah. And then so you're squeezing. And then that top dried part comes out and it's just blurts hand lotion everywhere. That's exactly what this is like. So all that stuff that is cooped up inside the box with the lid on, it's like the lid. And you're going to explode if you don't do something about it. So I like, my favorite way of journaling right now is doing that word dump or the brain dump. And then I actually do control A and highlight it all and then delete it right away, because that's the trusting in the process.
Yeah, exactly. Side of things. That, yeah. Whenever I go to conferences or events and, you know, everyone's sitting there writing down their notes that they'll never look at again, they'll be in a book and they'll take them home. And for me, it's like, no, I just sit in there and I try to take it all in and be very present in the moment and then trust that whatever was meant to stick in my brain will stick in my brain. Mm-hmm. Because through me sitting there writing, it's like I used to work as a photographer, and whenever I shot a friend's wedding, I was never in the emotional moment of the wedding. You know, we need to be in these things, not frantically taking notes on life all the time, but living it.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a friend who always posts about, you know, what she was doing like a year or 5 years ago. And I note this, she's not just doing the Facebook timeline thing. I know that she's going back into her journals and rereading things that she was doing as like a regular habit of rereading her journals. And that boggles my mind. I don't have the emotional wherewithal to care.
Yeah. But then there's also, you know, one of my favorite sayings is, what is for you won't go by you. You know, I don't know how many times I've had a really great idea and then been like, oh, I have to write that one down. And then wake up the next morning and be like, oh, fuck, I can't remember what the idea was. Oh, I'm so devastated. And then 6 or 12 months later, bump, there it is again.
There it is. Yep.
You know, so it's like, if it's meant for you, it's going to return.
I will say this, when I'm doing the brain dumps, if I come across like a to-do item, like, oh yeah, I need to send an email to somebody, I will actually write that out onto a different piece of paper because I actually don't want to forget that.
Yeah, totally.
But the other stuff, like if I'm like trying to come up with some, or if I start to think that the stuff I'm writing will become a piece of prose or a blog post later or whatever, I just delete it anyways, because like you said, if it's important enough, if it's actually thought out, I'll be able to pull it back out again.
Yeah, for sure. I think there's a big difference between something popping into your head and you having to act upon that in that moment, or, you know, like that, oh, I've got to write that email, then just write the email and have it done. But if you're writing something down to hold on to it just in case, then bye-bye, delete, gone.
Yeah, yeah.
Cool. Well, that's a good place to end.
Let's do it.
I won't delete this interview, though, because it's gold.
good.
Thanks so much.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been great.
Thanks for tuning in to the Carlosophies podcast with me, Carly Nimmo. Let's continue the conversation at carlynimmo.com. If you were a big fan of the podcast, I'd be stoked if you left a review. And if you want to hear more radness just like this, be sure to subscribe and spread the word. In the meantime, be real, be rad. Peace out.